search for a new home, and more celebrations as we continue in our 48th year of operation. If you cannot attend in person, you can tune in via Zoom. Details will be posted soon on the WPFW website. Through turbulence, transitions, and triumphs, still we rise as a community-powered radio station uplifting peace, justice, cultural expression, and the music that moves us. We look forward to adding your voice to WPFW for the unheard, as a rhythm for the people, and a light in times of darkness.
Peace, this is Atan Thomas, and you're listening to WPFW Washington, your station for jazz and justice.
Welcome, listeners. Welcome to WPFW 89.3 FM out of Washington, D.C., WPFWFM.org across your internet connections. My name is David Whetstone. I'm your host for this hour. The show is We the People. For new listeners joining us, We the People is a news magazine, usually reflecting a one-to-one interview, and we cover the topics of race, politics, history, and culture, particularly where they intersect, particularly where they leave us a legacy. The past gives us a legacy for the present and the future. In the present, people are active, doing things to affect our communities, our world, our societies. In the future, we hope to secure so it's a better place for everyone, because we here at WPFW seek to build better communities, at least one broadcast at a time. We are in the middle of a spring fun drive, a spring pledge drive. We seek social connectivity with you, and for those who are able, we need your financial support, your financial wherewithal. Again, for both new and regular listeners, you know that WPFW has been a site of resistance in defense of truth, justice, and culture for more than 48 years, and that's due to you, the listener, supporting us. We began our spring membership drive with a special celebration of James Brown's birthday. That's May 3rd, for those of you who want to know. And we close with a centennial birthday celebration of Malcolm X on May 19th. Two pillars of music and message. But in order to make that possible, your financial support is needed now more than ever. As a new listener or current member, this is your opportunity to contribute to the growth of an institution that stands resolute both against gross injustice and repression and the mass erasure of history and culture by amplifying the voices of scholars, artists, activists, community leaders, everyday folk whose work centers on the humanity of all people. So I'm going to thank you in advance because PFW works daily to build the world that we all want to be in. Again, building a better world, one broadcast at a time through jazz and justice. You can make your contributions, help me exceed the $500 goal by calling 1-800-222-9739, 1-800-222-9739. Without further ado, let's get to our topic, denial, how we hide, ignore, and explain away problems. Denial is so much a part of our lives that we deny its existence all the time, even when this works against our best interest. How could we not know? What does it mean to live in a society where such lying, fraud, and corruption is commonplace? We'll look at the forms and meanings of denial, exploring the behavior of those who refuse to acknowledge their actions, and what it means to live in a society where such lying, fraud, and corruption is commonplace. In order to do that, our guest is Jarrett Del Rosso. Dr. Del Rosso is an associate professor in the Department of Sociology and Criminology at the University of Denver. He has researched the interpersonal and collective dynamics of denial. His research and teaching in this area are the basis of his first two books, Talking About Torture and Denial, How We Hide, Ignore, and Explain Away Problems. Good morning, doctor, and welcome. How are you? I can't hear your audio at present. We're still trying. Bear with us, audience. While we're making that connection, I'm going to be joined later on in the show by my colleague and friend, Dave Rabin. He is the host of Community Watch and Comment, the Tuesday edition in this time slot. And we will proceed to dig into the topic of denial shortly.
David, can you hear me now?
Yes, we can hear you.
Sorry about that. The mic had been working for a little while.
These things happen. So sorry no about problem.
That. I'm so sorry about that.
So welcome aboard.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Thank you for that introduction. I'm so appreciative of the opportunity to be here with you all this morning.
All right. So let's ask for a basic definition, one that you work with.
Sure. Yeah, for sure. So I'm a sociologist, not a psychologist. And I think that's a helpful distinction to make because I think the study of denial is part and parcel of both of these disciplines in really important ways. When we're thinking about psychology, where we tend to think of the ways, you know, the ways in which we might describe someone as in denial, the ways in which they kind of imaginatively, cognitively, emotionally, essentially live in a state where they're not recognizing something critical about themselves or their situation. I think the sociological study of denial, which is what I'm up to, is in many ways similar, but I'm interested in the ways in which those denials become real among people, between people and among people. So for me, I'm really thinking about the strategies and the behaviors and the things that we say, the things that we do in our everyday lives, in our workplaces, in our politics, in our culture, that prevent us from really recognizing distressing things as they happen, harmful things as they happen. I love the language that you invoked at the introduction here when you talked about the erasure of history, the erasure of culture. I think that is one of the parts of denial that is most important to me in my work. And so really what we're talking about are the ways that people keep distressing things out of public view in the first place, or, you know, when we are in that realm of things that we might describe as undeniable, how we get creative, how people get creative, how societies get creative to downplay, minimize, transform those things that come to our attention that maybe are just distressful, uncomfortable, or potentially harmful.
Is there anything particularly different? I took notice of the first book that you produced, which was focused on torture. But as you move broadly, and you know, denial in all its forms and operations is replete. Certainly, the stakes that denial engages, or pun intended, disengages. There are many, many topics. So perhaps, again, you can even take us a step further as a sociologist, particularly how it fits into your work.
Sure. So my first book, talking about torture, was really a study of the politics of interrogation, detainee abuse, and torture during the Bush administration. I had been studying those since, I think, roughly 2006, 2007 as a graduate student in sociology. I have long had this kind of intersecting political and intellectual concern with violence and the ways in which, you know, kind of societies as a whole respond to or try to ignore violence that happens on behalf of them. I was an undergraduate during 9/11. I was an undergraduate during the invasion of Iraq. President Bush announced an end to major combat operations in Iraq, that infamous photo in front of a Mission Accomplished banner on my 22nd birthday. And then that conflict, as we all know, dragged on. And I was a graduate student studying violence, studying visual culture. I had questions about the erasure of violence in the early years of the war in Iraq. And then I also had questions about the ways in which the Abu Ghraib scandal in 2004, if you remember, the release of really graphic images of detainee abuse and torture in 2004, an election year, really changed public debate about violence, about the Iraq war, and especially about torture, and kind of opened a half decade long or more reckoning with detainee abuse. So that first book was really a study of the things that political elites, members of Congress especially, were saying about the evidence they had available about detainee abuse and torture, the ways that they were using language to frame, reframe, minimize the frankly, in a sense, you know, language always really has a powerful magic. And when that powerful magic is put to the end of erasing the suffering of others, it really operates as a form of denial. And so the ways that language was used to recast torture as enhanced interrogation, to recast torture as merely abuse, to offer justifications. And so that book really tracked it, tracked those changes. It went through Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo, CIA, waterboarding. And from there, I began teaching. I began teaching on torture. I began teaching on state violence. And then eventually I began teaching on denial. And when I got to that course on denial, as you said, it really occurred to me that denial is this really rich social force. You know, it has a role in the everyday interactions among people. And that role, as I think you put well, is not identical to its role in our politics, in our culture, although they are interrelated. And so what I did with that course and what I did with my book on denial is really try to track the movements of denial from what I think are some of the most benign things, like something embarrassing happens, you know,
spinach and
if my mic hadn't worked and you all just pretended nothing like happened. I was here, but you know, something else was going on and I couldn't get to you right away. Like the ways that we pretend these everyday small embarrassment aren't happening, the spinach in the teeth, as you were saying, all the way up into our politics, the more serious things, climate change, violence,
racism,
social inequality, injustice, those really critically important things that you all talk about so well here.
So, in being clear and in your thoroughness, you're identifying interpersonal and collective aspects of denial, because again, we're interested in what is this thing that's operating between us in our communities, in our politics, in our day-to-day living. Great.
Yeah.
I guess we have to do sort of the necessary thing. I have sociologists pegged. They're often very good with typologies. That's the identifying the different forms of stuff. But I suspect, even given your initial response to us, you want to go beyond just a mere list or a mere description. Some of the typologies I'll just start off with. Attention management is a way of denial. So if you can explain that and a few others, it'd be appreciated.
For sure. Thank you. And, you know, you're right that I'm both drawn to typologies and think we need to go past them. I think typologies are helpful because they help us see the world differently. When we have this language for describing what we're seeing, it can really help us see our interactions, see our politics differently. So, you know, the attention management strategies are really those that we use to keep distressing things, sometimes just simply mildly embarrassing things. But when we talk about politics, communities, and culture, those distressing topics that people are uncomfortable dealing with, the ways that we keep them from being recognized in the first place, or the ways that we pretend that they're simply not there, that we feign obliviousness, that we act as if, you know, at the case of individual interactions, the embarrassing event hasn't happened. At the case of politics, that we don't talk about the misdeeds. I mean, in some cases, we don't talk about the misdeeds of our political allies. We try to keep them out of the conversation in the first place. So yeah, really, attention management is about the behaviors, the language, the ways that we kind of organize the world to keep people from noticing in the first place that something has gone wrong, sometimes in small ways, sometimes in really significant and severe ways.
So we're going beyond descriptions, even with those descriptions that you talked about, tactful obliviousness,
yeah,
attention management, what sophisticates called discursive rhetoric, yeah, which is in plain English moving from one subject to another,
yeah,
adroitly,
pivoting,
putting on a hustle, so to speak. So I guess it's fair to ask of you and your discipline also, like, what's energizing this? One of the things that I think you make in observations is that many Americans believe that problems are, or the cause of most social problems, are linked to what individuals do.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess in the examination of denial, we're pushed beyond that, aren't we?
Yeah, for sure. For sure. And I think that's a wonderful question of what's animating it. And I think it comes, at least from me, and I think to a degree for others who've studied the collective denial of social problems, social inequality, social injustice, a concern for the ways in which powerful actors really shape our perception of the world, and the ways that they shape how we talk about these things in our lives, or how we don't talk about those things in our lives. And frankly, drawing attention to those strategies and those techniques, I think can help us begin to unwind them or undo them. And so partly, and this kind of goes back to those typologies, the question you were asking earlier, partly the work of this book, the animating drive around this book is to help people see denial in action. Because when we can describe what it's doing, we become better able to intervene in it, to take action, to take steps, to organize, to disrupt its work.
That being an ideal that we should practice, it's nonetheless very difficult. I think about crime that happens in public, on public transportation.
Sure.
We've moved throughout several decades now where it's well documented that people just quite frankly respond in paralysis. They don't respond. Mm-hmm. Or they pull out a video camera,
mm-hmm,
and behave in such a way that videoing the incident is not necessarily a completed intervention or an aid to what's going on.
For sure. And bystander behavior is at the core of public and everyday forms of denial. You know, the common kind of forms of denial that we're not thinking at the level of politics, elite actors that many of us might be involved in the everyday. And this is a really powerful social psychological framework that goes back at this point 60 years to the study of the bystander effect, emerging out of some really famous and infamous examples of public bystander behavior. The probably best known is the murder of Kitty Genovese in New York City in the early 1960s. And there was this sense at the time that people who live in cities are kind of callous and kind of detached from each other and uncaring. But what social psychologists really found is it's not that. It's the power of groups. It's the power of fear. It's the power of our own denial of responsibilities, because we think others who are there and present are better able to intervene or are likely to intervene or have already intervened. And so that work really pushed back on this idea that we're callous, that modern people, especially in cities, are callous or disconnected. Rather, it was showing that when we're around other people, and especially when we don't know how to take action, we're not likely to. We kind of get, as you put, like frozen in our inaction, and then denial clicks in, and we try to detach. We try to show that we're like, we try to engage in that tactile obliviousness so that we don't look as if we notice this distressing thing happening around us.
So Kitty Genovese gets murdered under the witness of 38 people who don't even call the police. Let me just slip in a quick example of a quandary, but mostly I want to tip off and ask the question that there's a role of cultural expectations that's at play. So Washington, D.C., public transportation is used heavily in this city, and we have a problem. Any given bus ride, 50% or more, and it gets pretty high, will just kind of shuffle. Each person has their different mannerism of engaging or not engaging the bus driver, and they come on. Further, people will play their phones or some electronic device really loudly, often in another person's ear, or if you're at one end of the bus, you hear it from another. People of all sorts of ages, and I want to encourage listeners not to conjure any stereotypes, because these behaviors cover a wide range of demographics. That's my point about cultural expectations. Feet in the seat, my bag deserves a seat since it's accompanying me. All those behaviors, and yet, again, people say nothing. You talked about fear, but I also think there's something else afoot there. And you talked about the urban stereotypes, both affirmed but also dispelled by sociology.
Sure.
What's going on here?
Yeah. And I think what you're describing is a not atypical scene of spaces where we're around high numbers of people, you know, urban city locations where you're passing by hundreds, thousands, I mean, in some cases, tens of thousands of people in what feels like a short moment. And so social psychologists have been studying the dynamics of urban interaction for a long time. And what they've shown is that we have all these kind of interactional skills that we've built up to try to remain just, I'm trying to think of the exact word I want here. Disconnected is close to it, but it's not exactly what I mean, because that kind of has a negative connotation, but uninvolved maybe in this mass movement of interactions around us. And so, you know, I talk to my students about this, and I say to them, what are some of the things you do when you're in a public setting, you know, public transportation, an airplane, you're just waiting in a public space to signal that I'm not open to interaction. And they talk about headphones, you know, putting in headphones. They might not even be listening to anything, but they'll have them in. And so we really have these interactional skills to just kind of get by on the everyday. And in some ways, those are just kind of basic social functions, social interactions. And then as we've talked about, they become more consequential when we use them to disinvolve ourselves in these distressing public situations, or if we start applying them to the workplace.
Well, thank you. Listeners, you're listening to We the People right here in WPFW. I'm your host, David Whetstone. Most importantly, I always say focus on our guest and topic. Dr. Jarrett Del Rosso, sociologist, is talking about denial, how we hide, ignore, and explain away problems. We are certainly here at WPFW to talk about our larger world, our society, the communities that we live in. We can only do all that by your assistance. And so when we talk about interventions and navigating life, as we're doing in this show, we also have to have your intervention, your navigation, your guidance and support by financially supporting the station. To help me do that, my colleague David Rabin is joining us. David, good morning, and thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's great being with you. I have a sociology background from UC Berkeley. Maybe that's where the professor might have gone to. I'm a little bit older than you, but I mean, it's just so, you know, I saw the topic, I thought, oh, it's going to be a discussion about psychology. I'm so glad it's sociology. It's so fascinating. It's
wonderful. We are spared for now.
Wonderful having you. And We're here. We need your support. This is very much a labor of love. You're listening to David and myself. We are volunteers. We do it because we care about the community. We enjoy doing it. And I think that we're dealing with extraordinarily vital topics, particularly given the current political climate. So please support this wonderful community resource that is WPFW, 1-800-222-9739. You can go online, WPFWFM.org, and do the whole thing online. It'll just take you two or three minutes.
The bright red button, find it.
Yeah. And you can do credit card, debit card, PayPal. We've got Cash App, $WPFWFM. We've got a $500 goal. We are nowhere near it, folks. We need you to show the love. Step up. We love the station. We think you do too. We need you to not just talk the talk, but walk the walk. We love sustainers. We love new members. Your donations are tax deductible, and I think I've spoken enough. Thank you so much for
well,
all
David,
you do.
Thank you. Again, 1-800-222-9739. Dave Rabin just mentioned that we have people who sustain us. Some of them do it within their means. So if it's $10 a month, $30 a month, or some do it with a one-time big gift. Surely out of the many people who listen to each and every hour here in your Jazz and Justice radio station, there might be 10 of you, there might be 20 of you that make these modest goals. Yet it's important to sustain us as a station. I believe it takes, I would say almost $300,000 a quarter to keep us going. We have a modest staff. And again, as Dave Rabin reminded you, we're volunteers. But I want you to volunteer. Again, 1-800-222-9739 for your donations that keep this Jazz and Justice station going. WPFW-FM, there's a bright red donate button to do it online. You can text to WPFW-FM by going to 801-801. Again, 801-801. And you just text the word WPFWFM to donate. We're going to thank you in advance. We're very, very grateful that we can engage you. But make that a reality. Support the station today. 1-800-222-9739. Dr. Del Rosso, again, nice to have you. I understand you want me to call you Jarrett, so I will proceed to do that. The time is getting away from us quickly. Let's examine responses to denial.
Sure. Yeah. So in the conclusion of my book, by the time I got done with writing this kind of field guide to all the ways that we are engaging in denial in our life, I wanted something more, not quite an antidote to that, but nearly so. So I was thinking about the ways in which we can respond and intervene in the forms of denial that we see in our everyday lives and maybe in our political and cultural lives. And I was kind of inspired here by the work of people who put together what are called bystander intervention programs, which are really excellent at training people into seeing distressing signs in their everyday life and taking action about those distressing signs. And those programs are pretty widespread in universities and workplaces across the country. And what they're really good at is helping people overcome that uncertainty about how to intervene and giving them the skills to know, what do I do next? Because we find as social psychologists that when people don't know what step to take, even if that step, that we're suggesting people take is really small, is really minor, but when people don't even know that first step, that is when they retreat into these bystander states. That's when they retreat into these bystander states. And then when I think about politics and culture at large, really helping people see that there are possibilities for intervening in public discourse, for bearing witness to denial as it happens, when we're seeing histories erased. And frankly, for me, I think one of the most potent places, because this is a place that almost all of us have access to, are in places like the organizations we're associated with, the workplaces we're associated with, because there it's like forms of groupthink that really lock us into inaction, lock us into false consensuses about what we believe, what we think, who we value, what we value. And really trying to promote the ability to disrupt those false consensuses was something that concluding chapter I was really kind of chasing after.
Well, there's a whole range. I mean, there's having the courage to name something any place and anywhere, yep, with a small number of people or a large number of people.
Yep, for sure.
There are times forced by the court and politics that people are encouraged to try to work their way through the system. So much for that. There's the whistleblower.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'll just stop at those three. There are all sorts of different degrees.
Yeah.
And sociologists, including yourself, have identified the strategies or techniques. Distraction. Is distraction a good thing in combating denial?
That's a wonderful question. And I describe it as one of the weakest ways we can disrupt denial. And yet in that regard, it can still be helpful. You know, by distraction, what I mean is you're noticing something going on in an organization, in a workplace. You're noticing maybe offensive speech. You're noticing people engage in behaviors that you kind of think they probably ought not to, that are probably inappropriate for their role. And so bystander intervention programs recognize that sometimes that fear of being the person who intervenes means we really can benefit from indirect ways of drawing attention to ourselves, drawing attention away from the people involved in the scenario, just simply kind of doing really small scale disruptions. The way I've encountered this is through the work of people who engage in bystander intervention programs around sexual assault at universities.
Yeah. So harassment situations. Yeah.
Yeah. And the first strategy that they promote, again, they recognize that this isn't the only strategy. You know, if you are a student at a university, you notice a situation where two people are engaging in interactions that you think are distressing, signal the potential for something bad to happen. You spill a drink, you bump into people, you do something that just disrupts the flow of interaction. That can be really powerful and that can get the job done. Distraction, though, when we're talking about these more collective, communal, political, cultural forms of denial, probably doesn't get us very far. But at the everyday life, that can be a really empowering way of just disrupting the flow of an interaction that you think is about to turn in the wrong direction.
Well, you're pointing out that it doesn't remedy the problem per se. In fact, in some regards, the risk is it dampens it. Mm-hmm. So you don't change a community or setting that lends itself to encouraging disrespect of people by harassment, for instance. I guess moving on, first I want to also say that the intervention could also be just really naming it strongly and clearly as well, because as you and other sociologists point out, if one person steps forward,
yes,
usually that breaks the barrier. It breaks the lockdown of things.
For sure.
But there's another way. I mean, establishing some sort of concrete witness, usually like a paper trail.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering about that. I think your discipline observes that when people do that, though, there's a certain grisly reality. What is that reality?
Yeah, for sure. I really like these two modes that you've described. The person who documents with the paper trail, the potential whistleblower, and also the person who names. I think these are both really powerful ways of different ways for sure, but powerful ways of documenting and disrupting the problems that we kind of live with or are in our midst. You know, whistleblowers, whistleblowing is one of these acts that gives me incredible hope for the potential of, in some cases, I mean, not literally just one person, but in many cases, it starts with one person. And this comes from my scholarship into torture. You saw people within the US military, within the FBI, within the kind of branch of the military associated with law, people who remained committed to international laws against torture, domestic laws against torture, the rule of law, the US Constitution, who were never swayed by the arguments for torture. And at first, those people might just document what they've witnessed. They put it in an email, they send it to higher ups. And eventually, when the moment is right, sometimes those documents are leaked to the press. Other times they are released through Freedom of Information Act requests. So especially those driven by the ACLU, those were really powerful ways in which we as a collective learned about the use of torture in our name as citizens. And some of these people were doing really heroic things because they faced backlash from superiors, supervisors. They faced backlash from communities, even family members, if they came from military families. I'm thinking especially of the person associated with Abu Ghraib, Joseph Darby, who was a whistleblower in that case, actually had his name spoken by Donald Rumsfeld very early as this scandal unfolds in a way that put him at grave risk. And so whistleblowing is not easy. People lose jobs. People lose kind of social support. And yet, if we are willing to take whistleblowers seriously, and this is where we kind of come in, if we are willing to not demonize them, we can really move forward in these kind of powerful ways.
Well, that's one of the things of the operators of denial, particularly authoritarians. You know, it's just sad that our present situation makes us all too familiar with that. They're called out of name. They're of low intelligence, or they're given even a racial slur nickname, or their credentials, which are usually over and abundant and obvious, are questioned, and so on and so forth. Or the actual disinformation is an actual distortion of both context and what the person has said or done. There's so much here, and it's almost endless. And in one way, this is the human condition. This is what we have to deal with. Mm-hmm. In another, it feels so unnecessary. It feels like the deception of denial is that it's a relatively easy thing to do in practice, yet it calls us to summon so much energy. And I think your observations, again, as well as sociology, points to us that there's a collective impact. Some of your work, you have a dedication to the examination of racism, and we can again talk both about what's going on, but also some of the responses as well. If you please, let's take a moment to do that before our next break.
For sure, for sure. And you know, I'm gonna take one particular kind of avenue through that as a person who is writing about denial, but as a person who's also an educator. For me, one of the most powerful ways in which both collective acknowledgement and collective denial happens is through the ways and the things that we teach. You know, I teach in a particular context at the university level, but those histories that we learn, and I think that you all allude to so effectively in the introduction to your show, those histories are taught, and they are part and parcel about the ways that we come into this world as young people. And both as an educator and as a scholar, it was kind of eye-opening to me how much I had to relearn, 15, 20 years into my career as a sociologist, counting undergrad and grad school, that simply never came up, especially about the history of race in sociology, the history of racism in sociology, the work of scholars who were kept at the margins of the discipline because of who they were and how they wrote about race.
Case in point, W.E.B. Du Bois.
For sure.
He's considered one of the premier foundations of American and probably international sociology as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so when I teach Du Bois, I show students in my class this study from about the time I was actually in grad school that looked at graduate level syllabi in sociology. And he was on one of 10, like 4 of 40 syllabi. He was not being taught when I kind of came of age as an academic. And so his was some of the work that I had to learn for the first time in many ways as a faculty member. And his writing, especially on how history around the Civil War, history around Reconstruction was taught and mistaught in America, the ways in which textbooks are implicated in that, the ways in which public education is implicated in that. You know, writing now 90 years ago, he was in his book, Black Reconstruction. And yet so many lessons for our ongoing, we can call them debates, we can call them controversies, but about the ways in which American history is being taught or not taught in classrooms and remembered in places like museums and memorials, potentially in statue gardens and things like those kinds of outlets of public memory.
Allow me to reintroduce you. Listeners, you're listening to We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone. More importantly, you're right here at WPFW 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org. We are broadcasting in a period where we seek your membership to the station. We're entirely listener supported. Because of that listener support, we've been around for 48 years, going strong. Because again, you, the listener, choose to support the station, and whether it's by large means or modest means, it's appreciated. I thank you for that. So lend your support to WPFW today. The number is 1-800-222-9739. And to help me make this appeal, my colleague, David Rabin. David, thank you again for rejoining us. I am watching the tally board just like you are, and we've got a little phenomenon going on here. Even sociology can't help us. People are probably well gripped by our guests, and I appreciate that. So they're waiting toward the end of the show to call. But as you said earlier, we need you to call now.
Now.
Online, you can still listen to the show and do your donation online. Please do so. Dave, give us some further encouragement, if you please.
I mean, 1-800-222-9739, WPFWFM.org. Go online and do a quick credit card, debit card, PayPal, Cash App, $WPFW. Such an important topic that David is doing. He's doing it all the time. I was looking back at some of his previous shows, a whole show on the incredible poet, writer, activist, Nico Giovanni. I mean, you don't get this kind of programming elsewhere. You hear it here on WPFW. And I should say, we are listener sponsored. We don't get any corporate underwriting. We get no government help, which is terribly important, I think, this day and age.
Yes, it
given
is.
Given our political climate. But we are listener sponsored. We are the original model way before PBS, way before NPR, 1949. It was the whole idea of listener sponsorship. But that means we need you all to step up and sponsor us. It's a model that only works if we get your support. So please chime in. And I want to Femme la bouche, as we would say in French, and get back to our important guest who's giving such wonderful context to the current political climate that we are living in.
So that number again is 1-800-222-9739. 800-222-9739. Jared, I'm so thankful that you're with us this morning. And we're getting into the responses and what we can do about it. But it's not just the interpersonal. It's not just being angry over politics. The stakes are high with the pervasive presence of denial. So here's what I would ask. We have to do more than recognition of the problems. And I suspect even you as a sociologist, there's still a lot of ambivalence, mystery, stress, and tensions. Given that we have about 6 minutes or so left, how would you begin to get us beyond recognizing denial and doing something more?
Sure. That's a wonderful question, a hard question for sure. And one that maybe troubles my teaching on denial, troubles the book a bit. I'll say that, you know, I wrote the end of this book in March and April 2020. a while ago now. You know, we knew about COVID, but we had not yet moved in to those long years with COVID. We knew about police brutality, but we had not yet seen it play out in Minneapolis. And so during my time teaching amid COVID, during my time thinking about how this work kind of translated, I was drawn to what I think might be the mirror image of denial, which is a notion of hope. And hope, we sometimes gets a bad name because we think of it as this kind of naive idealism that like things will inevitably get better. And it did not feel like that.
Doesn't happen automatically, does it?
It does not happen automatically. And frankly, one of the things I was drawn to, I had this book on my shelf for years, was a short book called Hope in the Dark by Rebecca Solnit. Really wonderful and powerful book. And what Solnit conveys is that hope is based in an uncertainty that the future is yet to be determined. And when I bring that to my students, when they read that, they have this initial reaction of a little bit of discomfort. Uncertainty is uncomfortable. We wish we kind of knew what the future would hold. And again, I keep going back to your introduction because I just so much loved it. Like learning about legacies for this moment so we can build something. That idea that what we do in the present matters, but also a recognition that we don't yet know how it matters, which is what Solnit emphasizes. We don't yet know who it will matter to. We don't know yet when it will matter. It may not bear immediate fruit. And so it takes a bit of an act of faith. It takes certainly working with others, working in community-based organizations, to begin taking actions in the present and then having that faith that because the future is yet decided, eventually this will matter and may help us overcome denial. And then I also just remain inspired by the work of people who have disrupted denial. I've invoked whistleblowers. I have a lot of kind of awe and respect for the work of people who do that. The work of people who take the brave step of when there is a false consensus among people, just speaking out and saying what others are thinking but are not willing to say, I think is also really powerful and a really kind of impressive way that we can begin to intervene.
Well, intervention is important. I've just came out of a break with the pledge drive that we need, the membership drive, and someone's got to start it. And I want to thank Nadine out in Prince George's County to get us going. Folks, it's very, very important. Don't wait to the last few minutes. We're closing out our conversation. That's very important. But you can call 1-800-222-9739. Jarrett, what you were talking about is moving in deep acknowledgement to action. And again, your work reminds us of a number of things. There's always a counterpoint. Just as there are all these possibilities of denial, there are all these possibilities of acknowledgement and of action. You know, the sad thing you were talking about as an educator, that in your own experience, you're not told or you're not taught or, mm-hmm. you know, often, again, if we go back to racism and anti-racism, you know, there's outright denial, there's withdrawal, I don't need this, I know enough to deal with this issue. And depending on who says that, it's a rather unfortunate statement, to be frank. Again, the courage to name things, those people in power, one I like to point out is called temporal containment. That happened way in the past, and it's over. And because we're human, even though I deny you're human in my heart, you should have gotten over this, or your people should have done better. Because after all, under American exceptionalism, we're all thriving and ever achieving and ever ascending. So there are all those things. Again, I think you're pointing to more recognition of the problem. But again, the advantage you give us is that we can do more than just merely react or not react.
For sure. And I think also recognizing that these strategies are old when we see them show up in the contemporary moment. They can feel new. They can feel like they don't have a history, but they do. And they also have a history of being disrupted and finding inspiration in the efforts people have made. You know, just pointing out very briefly that Du Bois was pointing out 90 years ago the ways that history was twisting the reality of race and racism in this country, and then to have ongoing debates about the place of these in the teaching of history. And
for him, it was more contemporaneous. I mean,
yeah, for
President
sure.
Wilson was in office. There was many racial massacres and arrests, generalized by calling them riots.
Yep.
So there was this moral equivalency that just simply wasn't true. You know, I was thinking about examples you've cited, but others, like Elaine, Arkansas, the expression mow them down by using a machine gun was started with that massacre of a multiracial farmer cooperative who were only advocating for their rights. Finally, the Tulsa massacre is known as the Tulsa massacre and not the Tulsa race riots. So I think you're pointing us to both clearly and gently but steadily that even with the counter reactions of those who try to benefit from denial, there will always, always be a counter reaction for acknowledgement and better actions. We're coming up at the close. I usually don't freestyle, but I want to give you the last minute or two to just say anything that you might think we're missing or you'd like to add in this hour.
I think that was wonderful. In terms of just missing, I think remaining tethered to the fact that the long arc of history shows that these strategies of denial will be used again, and they can be, as you said, we can have these counteractions of acknowledgement. So I very much appreciate your closing comments.
And you pointed out very well that the technique, the language, the behavior, it's rather limited. It is not as all powerful as it seems upon first intimidation.
No, exactly. And what we do matters. And I think that's the underlying point in intervening in denial.
Well, thank you. Again, Jarrett Del Rosso. Dr. Del Rosso is associate professor of the Department of Sociology and Criminology at the University of Denver. His book, Denial, How We Hide, Ignore, and Explain Away Problems, has been the basis of our conversation. Thank you for your generosity, Jarrett, and we appreciate your work. Folks, we've got some housework to do. $500 must be made in this hour. That is the frank statement that I need to make and not deny with you. You can help us get to that goal. Dave Raven is laughing, but it's the truth, brother. We each have to do our share. And I'm not sitting here behind the mic for nothing. Someone out there could get a big chunk of that $500 knocked down for us. And we use it to pay the electric bills, the 10 staff people, to keep things going. But most important, that money is the empowerment of people behind the mic like Dave Raben, Muiza Mutali at 1 o'clock with Africa Now, a program about African descended people, not only in the continent, but throughout the world. Zen El Amin at 2 with Shea Wanana, Mint and Tea, talking about Middle Eastern affairs. Sophie's Parlor at 3, which brings you music and culture by women before everyone. Those are just a few examples why people should pick up the phone, call 1-800-222-9739. Dave Raben, take us further, please.
Yeah, and you got that number. You can also give at WPFWFM.org. You know, it just occurred to me, you know, hearing you speak with this wonderful sociologist, capitalism is eating up our awareness. It's eating up our consciousness. It's insidious. It affects how our government operates. It affects how we even perceive each other. So we want you to fight it. Fight it with us. We are a listener-sponsored, non-commercial radio. Show your support, 1-800-222-9739. And I think we are out of time. Great show, David. Great being with you.
Well, thank you for being with us. Folks, as the show closes, you can still contribute either by calling 1-800-222-9739 888-222-9739 or making your donation. Please name me the people so our management knows that people are listening by going to wpfwfm.org. As always, I thank you for spending your hour with us, particularly this hour. I wish you well. Hopefully you've been empowered and encouraged by our guests and the subjects at hand. Hopefully again, we'll meet on the radio. Take good care.
WPFW has been a site of resistance in defense of truth, justice, and culture for 48 years. Our spring membership drive begins with a special celebration of James Brown's birthday, May 3rd, and closes with a centennial birthday celebration of Malcolm X on May 19th. Two pillars of music and message. Your financial sustenance is needed more than ever to continue this type of programming. As a new listener or current member, this is your opportunity to contribute to the growth of an institution that stands resolute against both gross injustice and repression and the mass erasure of history and culture by amplifying the voices of scholars, artists, and activists whose work centers the humanity of all people. That's 48 years of being a site of resistance in defense of truth, justice, and culture, May 3rd through the 19th. WPFW works daily to build the world we want to inhabit by building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
The talk show Africa Now airs Wednesdays at 1 p.m. It's a modern view on historical issues concerning the entire African world, addressing how African people are participating in globalization, ways in which the rest of the world continues to exploit African resources, uncovering labor violations by corrupt politicians and Western government powers. Learn what's happening now in interviews with artists, activists, scholars, and a host of other experts each episode. Listen Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Africa Now is also available on iTunes Podcast, Google Play Music, as well as SoundCloud on your station for jazz and justice, WPFW, Washington.
My Body, My Festival 2025, DC's only abortion access music festival, is coming May 16th and 17th. Presented by the DC Abortion Fund and Burger Sounds, My Body, My Festival will take place at the Black Cat and Union Stage, featuring local artists across genres, including Alex Vaughn, Carly Harvey, Cicely, Taisha Estrada, B. Steadwell, Zoe Jorgensen, and more. My Body, My Festival is a celebration of our city and ensuring abortion care is available to all who need it. Details at mybodymyfestival.com.
I'm Janelle Anderson. I've been listening to WPFW since the 80s. It has helped manage my lifestyle in that listening to health programs turned me away from the hormone antibiotic meats. I've been a pescatarian since I had my girls listen to WPFW on the way to school, in that I believe they became organizers for justice. One co-founded a justice club in her high school, and another helped organize demonstrations. And I think today they are the better for just listening to those morning programs. I love the diverse format, from jazz to inspirational to talk. The programming has really grown me, and for those reasons and more, I support WPFW.
The WPFW Local Station Board will host a town hall meeting on Saturday, May 17th, from noon to 2:30 p.m. at the New Bethany Baptist Church, 1300 10th Street Northwest in Washington, D.C. Our theme is WPFW, Still We Rise. Featured speakers include representatives from station management, the Pacifica National Board, our programmers, and LSB volunteers. Listeners are invited to learn about new initiatives, finances, our search for a new home, and more celebrations as we continue in our 48th year of operations.